You're listening to the Rural Advancement Podcast. Rural Advancement provides resources to empower, equip, and encourage rural pastors and churches. Join our community by visiting us at ruraladvancement.com.
Hello and welcome back to Rural Advancement. This is the podcast that is by rural leaders and for rural leaders. It is our goal every single week, week in and week out, to bring you content that is not just spoken to the rural church, but is spoken by people who get it. People who have lived, worked, and ministered in small, out-of-the-way places, and people who understand the immense value of the work that God does there. I am your host, Joe Epley, and this week we're going to dive into part two of a conversation with pastor and college president, Martin Geese. Last week he began to tell us not only about his own story, his long tenure as a rural pastor, and also his current role of president of Oak Hills Christian College. But as he dove into his story, we got to learn a little bit about the mindsets that tend to collide in our rural churches that we may or may not be aware of. As pastors and leaders, this can be really helpful to understand why people are making certain decisions and how we navigate these kind of mindset-driven landmines in our own context. And so as we dive into part two, I encourage you just to keep taking it in. See if any of this sounds like a church situation you've encountered. And I pray that you would leave this conversation feeling encouraged to tackle the problems that are in front of you. And so without further ado, let's dive into part two. But let's do this. Let's take maybe points along the journey you just shared where these contrasts have been mentioned and dive deeper into them. So one of the things that I'm always concerned with is taking theory, making it pragmatic. And so you have kind of postulated that often these two forces of urban and rural are impacting or colliding in the rural church setting. And so just speaking very practically, what are one of the two of the most common ways these tensions do show up in local churches? If I'm a local church pastor, what should I be expecting as probably the biggest headaches or biggest potential headaches from this kind of divide, you know?
Sure. Let's talk about that. Let me once again, Joe, preface what I'm going to say in answer to your question with a bit of background. As I mentioned, my own journey of beginning to study the contrast because I was seeing them happen. In the first church that I served, we were very, very rural and would have been in parallel socioculturally with a number of the most rural locations in America. The second church that I served was very, very urban. That is, we had rural people in their history, background, and lineage, but we were in a resort area of northern Minnesota. Minnesota is known for its lakes, and so people gravitate there. And we had many early retirees from suburban locations who owned lake homes in the area. And so that second church that I served for a couple of decades was really a laboratory in terms of the contrast between rural and suburban. Additionally, both my graduate projects, a master's degree and a doctoral degree, drilled deeper into these contrasts. And so it's not just my observation, but the data. I did extensive ethnographic surveys around North America. The data supports the assertion that the rural urban collision, cultural collision, is really almost normative now in rural churches. One other factor, and then I will answer your question. One other factor is that the advent of social media, which is primarily representing a suburban mindset, that's not an indictment. So Let me be clear. We're not contrasting good versus bad at all. We're just highlighting differences in culture. But the advent of social media and its pervasive presence has really brought that suburban mindset to rural areas. So whether or not people of a church have different backgrounds, they are exposed to the contrasts. Sure. And so that collision, either more dramatic or less dramatic, is happening. So to answer your question about what are some of the most common tensions that would appear in intracultural collision in a local church, one has to do with time versus money. The realities of suburban life give great value to time and time management. Most suburban people are compressed for time. One of the results of that, Joe, is that suburban people will sacrifice money in order to save time.
Sure.
In contrast, rural people look at life through a different lens, and they will sacrifice time in order to save money. Money, at least cash, liquid assets, are in short supply. In Montana, for instance, a rancher who's operating a cow-calf operation, he may own rather expansive piece of real estate. He may have quite a bit of investment in his cattle herd. You know, that's a
Yeah.
substantial investment. But he may not be able seasonally to generate very much cash, because to do so, he'd have to sell land or to sell cattle. And to do either one would mean he's out of business in some
Right.
ways. So you could look, and you won't have a chance to do that because rural people are very private about this.
Yeah, I can't. I was just thinking to myself, I was like, I am not allowed to ask people how much land they own. That's just very taboo.
No, and you typically in Montana better not ask how many cattle they run either, because
That's
you're
true.
asking about the bank account.
Yeah.
But having said that, let's theoretically say if you were to peer over the shoulder of that rancher who's part of your church and see the net worth statement, you'd say, wow, that's a lot of worth.
Yeah.
On the other hand, that rancher may legitimately say to you as a pastor, I'm not able to contribute very much right now to ministry. I do have a, I'll be selling, you know, calves later in the season, and there'll be some money that's freed up then. And so rural people are good at conserving, being frugal during those lean times. They have generous hearts, but they have to deal with their realities. So once again, back to that, one of the premier contrasts, one group sacrifices time to save money. The other group sacrifices money to save time. Now, let me boil that down further, a little more granular level. So the church that you're serving has a ministry initiative that it needs to move, feels it needs to move forward with. And I'm going to define it even further. Let's take a building expansion, Joe.
Sure.
So our church auditorium has out of space, and we're going to need to add some worship space and maybe some education space. And so your church board, and traditions vary in how they're constructed in terms of leadership, but let's just say a church board then meets to discuss this. And at the table, you have, and I'm going to tilt the contrast even further, you have an older rancher, and you have a younger, someone who's new to your community, a young entrepreneur from a suburban background, and he's got internet access in your community, so he can live wherever he wants in the country, and he likes the mountains, and he's looking up the hill, Joe, from you in Billings. He's seeing the south end of the Crazy Mountains, are beautiful, sun setting against that snow, and this is where he wants to live. He wants to live just outside of Billings, and we're going to talk about this building expansion. And you will hear, almost predictably, the older rancher say, "Pastor, I don't care if it takes a little longer to get this addition built, but we've got to save money."
Yeah, got to be cash in hand, you know?
Right. And then the younger entrepreneur on your board will say, not necessarily arguing, but he'll represent the other view. He said, "Pastor, I don't care if it costs a little more. We got to save time. We got to get this thing done."
Yeah.
Now, here's one of the problems, Joe, with regard to that difference of opinion. We all, that's true for all of us, we all tend to hedge our perspectives a little bit. So the problem arises that the rancher may be saying deep down, "Pastor, I don't care if it takes a decade or more.
Sure.
We got to pay cash." And the young leader may be, in fact, saying to himself, "I don't care if it costs twice as much. We got to get this done.
Sure.
And I might not be able around to pay for it later on anyway. Let's just do it." You know, and pastors have to navigate not only the realities, but the subtleties in terms of using wisdom. And I've just given one example, but that's a contrast. Let me give you another one. It has to do with a sliding scale of excellence in what we do. On the rural side, the constraints of work weeks, we haven't talked about that yet, Joel, but during planting and harvest as a farm boy, we used to joke, I work a 40-hour week by Wednesday, and then on
Yeah.
Thursday, I start the second 40-hour week.
Right.
And seasonally, ranchers will do that as well, you know, branding time, and there's just a lot
Yeah,
of
calving. I mean, there's just a lot of work to be done. Yep.
calving. Yeah. So often in rural churches, the standard of excellence is good enough is good enough. I was heartened here 2 or 3 years ago in the Global Leadership Summit. Pastor of a very, very large mega church reached back and embraced that ethic to set his people free. He uses the acronym GITMO, good enough to move on. That
Yeah, there you go.
was his acronym. But generally speaking, rural people will just do the best they can under the constraints that they have. And on the suburban or urban side, excellence is expected. Now, again, let me contrast that rather dramatically. I'm exaggerating for emphasis, but I'm tapping
Sure.
into real realities. So in a rural church, typically we thank the Lord if we have a musician who can play a keyboard, a piano, if we have one. Now, if that musician is a homemaker, tilting to the female side at this point, a homemaker and maybe works as another job outside the home, the time to practice for the worship experience on Sunday is limited. And the church will be very, very grateful for her best efforts.
Yeah.
One of my past colleagues, in contrast, was a missionary supported by a very large church in Michigan who had, and I'm not making this up, 100 keyboard capable people.
Yeah.
100. You know, we would in rural ministry, we can hardly envision it.
Yeah.
Of the 100, Joe, 96 didn't play. Why? Because the lead two musicians were international recording artists, and the backup two were extraordinary talents. And so they're in that very, very large setting. Over 90% of the giftedness could not be utilized regularly just because of that excellence ethic. So I'm not denigrating either side of this. I'm just highlighting when you have a blended church, people will struggle a little bit with this. So how good is good enough? And
Right.
should we do a better job in this, or is that okay? And there are limitations in most rural churches with regard to people resources, and that can be a talking point. A third one, there are many, but these are just three for pastors. You can expect on the rural side greater caution in making any decision,
Yeah.
in facing any change. Why is that? Well, there are a lot of contributing factors, Joe, but one of the major factors is that if a change doesn't work out, rural people don't have any place to run or any place to hide. And so if a change or a decision leads to a failure, and undoubtedly some changes will, some
Right.
decisions will. I mean, that's just life. It leaves a lingering cost to the folk who initiated that in rural settings. So there's extra care given to make good decisions, to make them carefully, so they don't have to do any do-overs. There's not any residual fallout, framing it a bit tongue in cheek. While God in His Word has promised, "Your sins I will remember no more," rural church members have not made that promise. And if you make a bad decision, they remember, sometimes multiple generations. And so there's a caution. On the suburban side, where the pace is faster historically, decisions come in large numbers, have to be made almost daily in a corporate setting, or in fact, they are made daily, hour by hour in a corporate setting. It's a percentage game. So today we're going to make 100 decisions, large and small. Hopefully 90 of them go well. We've got 10 oops, and we just go on. You know, we pick up and go on. As a pastor, you're going to have folk in a urban combination that on the suburban side appear to be very impatient. Why are we debating this over and over and over? Get the decision made. On the rural side, folk will be feeling typically, why are you pushing so hard on this? We need
Yeah.
to pray this through. And even in, you know, within traditions, the word pray through, that phrase, very important phrase in evangelical churches. Pray through. Well, on the rural side, pray through is a long, much longer process. On the suburban side, well, we've prayed about it and we feel we have the heart of God, and let's just move. So those would be three examples of tensions that appear in the blend.
Yeah, and I really love you highlighting those again. What I consider one of the, you know, tests of this tried and trueness of what we share is just even being able to reflect on my own experience going, wow, yeah, I can see how all those tensions played out in my small town church, you know, of just wanting to get decisions done and wanting to, them to, you know, save time and all these things. And man, let's dive into another perspective here, because I was just intrigued by a particular metric you mentioned that kind of is different from rural versus urban. And we talk about the difference between survival and achievement, right, as a mindset, which you've already hit on. But what most interests me, and again, it's similar to our last question, but really, I do think that, like, sometimes as a pastor, I think you are ready to get something done. And yet you recognize that these growth metrics that are handed to you by other pastors and other conventions and other conferences that say you should be adding this program, doing this software, you know, updating this policy in your church, you know, aggressively pursuing X goal in the community. And then you go back to your church and you have a group of people who predominantly, it can feel like, are just kind of holding down the fort, you know, and it's not, I don't think it's again, like you said, it's not denigrating either mentality, but maybe talk to us about this, you know, what does it look like? How does a pastor, I guess, thread that needle, you know, of honoring those who are in that survival mode, but also working to grow and to build? Like, how do we honor both of those in a church?
That's an excellent question, Joe, and not an easy one to answer or to navigate through as a leader. I'm an advocate of several things, and having 40 years of experience, you know, and struggle and learning and, you know, success and failure, all of that, I by no means know everything there is to know about this stuff. I'm a fellow learner still.
Sure.
But I like to encourage leaders to do everything they can to celebrate God's grace in the past and to use that as a catalyst for moving towards achievement in the future. Since biblical times, there's always been a tendency to put a stake in the ground. God did an amazing thing. We're going to memorialize that and just stay there, remembering the past. But the reality is we've been called to move into the future, to be faithful today. So you don't have the luxury as a leader to simply go one direction or the other. You don't have the luxury of ignoring one side of this equation. I encourage leaders to think about the DNA of the congregations they serve. For instance, if a church has had success in ministry to children through the years, and now some of the methods they're using are getting antiquated, as a leader, you want to really affirm God's blessing on children's ministry. I'm bridging into another related area here a little bit. But if you're no longer effective in what you're doing, you need to change methodologies. Or if God has provided a new opportunity, your community, in the Intermountain West, you know, they discovered resources in your area that they're going to tap, whether it's oil or copper or gold, or, and all of a sudden you've got a growth spurt and folk are moving into your town. You can't just ignore that. So celebrate what God has done in the past, and then talk early, begin to envision growth as you tap into new opportunities. Envisioning growth ahead of time will help your rural people to be less anxious about projected change. One of the metrics that I've used successfully, it was passed on to me, it's not mine, nothing new under the sun. So if you're serving a church of 25 weekend attenders, you should find a church of 50, it's a doubling metric, that is succeeding, and ask, what are you doing to succeed with that number? If you're in a church of 50, you should find in your region of the country a healthy church of 100 and find out how are you operating? What's required? What are your Sunday school requirements? How do you handle? If you're in a church of 100, find a church of 200, might have to travel further. But find out, if we were to grow to that point, what would we have to face? Then you can come back and discuss that when it's not pressing you at the door, and just talk a little bit. You preload those discussions a bit. So keep on celebrating what God has done in the past, but really, as a pastor, preach, teach, and read the scriptures with your congregation with regard to what it means to press forward in the grace of God into new opportunities. Some, I should add, Joe, that some of those opportunities may not be local.
Sure.
I'm an advocate of getting some of your people into a cross-cultural mission experience. So if you're in a rural church in Montana, get somebody over to Bozeman or Billings, or what's your town on the west side?
We have Kalispell, Missoula, you know, all
yeah,
those places.
Get them over there to do a soup kitchen or something that, you know, engages them. If you have the means, and many, many rural folk do, get them to Mexico to give them a cross-cultural experience. It will energize your local and regional perspective to expand your ministry vision in a new setting.
Wow. Yeah, that's some solid wisdom. I definitely like that two-pronged approach of saying, hey, we will grow and we will like attempt to expand the kingdom, but we're not going to do it with our eyes shut to the past and the eyes shut to the sacrifices that people have made. I think that's, man, just a lovely mindset. Let's talk about this one. And again, these are terms that I just had the pleasure of picking out of the material that you shared with me. But I think this next one hits home for me, right? Because and I'm excited to hear you either define this term in a way that I think you're about to define it or maybe not. But I consider myself an optimist, right? I consider myself to walk in and just get excited about what's going on and to, you know, cast big enthusiastic visions and kind of try and really drive hard to make those visions a reality. But I was intrigued just by your use of these words. And so you mentioned a term of like rural pessimism as kind of this maybe survival oriented thing, but I'll let you explain it further. But then you have this urban offensive optimism is how you described it. And I just would love for you to break down those terms. What does it mean? And again, I know we're kind of hitting that bell over and over, but how does this relate to the church world, you know?
Sure. No, happy to do that. So let me toss out a couple of related definitions again for clarity. In my training of rural leaders, we talk about the dynamic of, on the rural side of coping with uncertainty. And I identified or just gave it a term some years ago. I suggest that rural people often will protect themselves psychologically by donning the cloak of pessimism. Now, I'm going to give you a bit of a wordy definition.
Sure.
The agrarian people wrap themselves in a cloak of pessimism, which serves as a psychological protection against dashed hopes. Now, here's how it works, Joe. If you expect the worst and the worst happens,
right,
the worst is expected.
Sure.
You can say to yourself, well, I saw it coming.
Yeah.
And bad doesn't seem so bad.
Yeah.
But if you expect the best, bad is very bad, and the worst may be unbearable. Let me unpack that a little bit. Because of the historic unpredictability of rural realities, I'm not suggesting that it's a biblical response, but it's a common response. I'm going to double down, kind of put my head down, resolve to move forward, expecting the worst. I too am an optimist by nature, Joe, and so if you are new to rural environments, you might have a conversation that goes something like this. Well, good morning. I don't know what's so good about it. Well, it's nice weather. We're having sunshine, and yeah, it keeps on shining, Pastor. The grass is going to burn up. The crops are going to
sure.
shrivel, but they're forecasting rain, says the pastor. And the farmer rancher says, yeah, and you just wait, Pastor. When it comes, it's going to be 10 inches. The gullies are going to flood. We're going to see cattle die. The crops are going to wash out. And by that time, by the third or fourth cycle of this, if you're an optimist, you're going, how did I ever get here?
Yeah, I'm already exasperated mentally just hearing this hypothetical. I'm like, come on, give me something to work with, you know?
Now, again, let me be clear. I'm not endorsing that, but I'm just identifying it as a reality. And
sure.
It will vary from person to person. We need to affirm for our rural folk that God is with us in the unpredictable, that we're not responsible to protect ourselves fully psychologically, but be gentle. Don't don't yell at the person who's had some bad experiences and who's defending themselves. There is a corollary. It doesn't get to the offensive optimism quite yet, but I will get there, Joe. The corollary on the urban side, we talk about rural coping with uncertainties. The corollary on the urban suburban side is coping with overload, with compression. So I call it on that side the protective cloak of detachment. Not all, but many urban people wrap themselves in a cloak of detachment, which serves as a psychological protection against emotional overload. If I do not notice, I won't have to care. And if I don't have to care, I can cope. But if I do notice, I'm compelled to care and may not be able to cope, crushed by the endless responsibilities and need. If you're in a large urban metroplex, there are so many needs around you. It is impossible to engage all of those. You can't. You can't. Just the commute to work in the morning is an odyssey. And you have to develop some sort of mechanism to be selective. Now, let's bring this back to your question and into a local church setting. Sometimes in a local church, this hesitancy on the rural side, the insecurity, and our cloak of pessimism will cloud the spiritual judgment of the church. They need strong transfusions of the glory of God, the grace of God, the provision of God through the past. There it is again. Look, he's never let us down. He's not going to in the future. In exasperation, some of the suburban folk on your turf are going to double down on their vision and their optimism and their enthusiasm.
Why can't we just try it? You know, like what's so
Let's
bad
do
about
it.
that? Yeah.
Let's get the job done. And so when I use the term offensive optimism, is there's nothing wrong with optimism. I want to be clear about that.
Right.
But in the setting of a local church, it will feel to the rural church members offensive that these folks surrounding them, who incidentally are new, even if they've been there 50 years, because the rural people have been there 150 years, the new people are in our face, and we don't like that. So as a pastoral leader, be aware of the possibility of that collision. If you do have the opportunity to take those suburban folk aside, just let them know that, hey, these are good folk here, survived a long time. Help me to encourage them, and we'll move forward. God's in this. On the rural side, you'll need to do some challenging and some cheerleading. There's the Eeyore perspective is not biblical. Tapping Winnie the Pooh here. Things they have you used this phrase, Joe? Things always look darkest before they get totally black. That's not biblical. That's pessimistic. And God can be trusted to get his bride to the wedding on time. And there's some things we need to do between now and then. So you have to be a student of both sides of this issue and maintain somehow there's, I call it the three languages you have to become fluent in: the language of the Bible, which is preeminent, and then an understanding of rural culture and understanding suburban and their differences.
And I think this part of our conversation is going to draw to a close, but I really loved the various points we've dipped into this subject because I'm a firm believer that if we can at least understand the dynamics at play in our churches, then it gives us, I don't know, a lot more skill or ability or heads up in navigating these dynamics. And so I want to say, yeah, thank you just for helping us understand. I do think we have time for maybe one last question, probably 3 to 4 minutes here, but I want to turn now to something we really haven't focused on a ton, and that is your role as president of a Bible college. And so this one just intrigues me because I want to arm our listeners with something practical in terms of, we've just spent a while of this conversation saying, hey, we need to learn, we need to be learners. I know you've talked about your own posture as a learner and just the desire to be more fully equipped to jump into our context, both feet forward, to see the kingdom of God move forward in these small out of the way places. And so I'd just be intrigued to hear your perspective as a Bible college president to say, you know, you get this opportunity to be a leader. When you look ahead to the future of pastoral training for rural leaders, what do you think that looks like? And I'm going to kind of preface it with this idea that, like, and I don't know how it is in your particular tribe or circle of Christianity, but in our camp as the Assemblies of God, we pretty consistently talk about money as an issue for higher education. We talk about just the ability to leave and go somewhere and do that and take a season of life. We talk about some of the mentalities that exist in small towns against maybe sometimes higher education and feeling like that qualification is too, you know, kind of set someone on a pedestal in a way. And so, but I want to effectively train rural leaders, and I want to see rural leaders to effectively grow and in their skills and their knowledge. And so what do you think the future of this looks like for the rural church?
Sure. I'll try to be as succinct as I can here, Joe. It's not going to be like a continuation of the past. And that's obvious to folk from a lot of traditions. Now, very few pastoral candidates are able to afford 4 years of Bible college, 3 years of seminary, and the accumulated education debt and go forth to a rural church of limited means,
right,
and make that work. It just isn't happening. Additionally, on the bad news side of this, or the challenge side, that's a better way to say it. Current pastors are aging. I think the average age is late 50s now. Sure. Fewer pastors are being trained across the kingdom, Joe. Pastors are being trained to replace them. Trained leaders with high skills are in great demand. So it's a competitive market. Every tradition that I'm aware of and interface with is not able to fully fill their rural pulpits at this point. So we're in the midst of a real challenging situation. Now to your question, successful rural pastors of the future, I believe, will have to continue to be lifelong learners. We're never done learning.
Sure.
Tapping into a variety of training resources, much wider bandwidth than previously. Books, yes, seminars, webinars, online information, podcasts like this one. Excellent, excellent. We developed at our college a 2-year with a third-year internship, fast track to rural pastoral leadership, which is grow your own. Churches are sending their leaders to be trained to be their pastors because they're not going to get one from the outside. That's going well, by the way. Many leaders in rural settings will need to be bivocational, creatively employing non-ministry skills. Everything's a ministry in
right,
in
right. But I feel
bivocational. Yeah. Smaller rural churches in more isolated and remote settings are going to have to explore collaborative partnerships with other area churches, even across denominational lines. And I realize that's complex.
Wow, that's a fun one, yeah.
Perhaps sharing pastors and resources. Multi-site parishes are going to be more common. What the modern version of the circuit riding pastor is going to be more common.
Sure.
I'm going to be preaching at this station this week, the next station the next week. And simulcasting is going to become, which was once the purview of large suburban, that's going to become more and more normative in rural settings. All of those realities, I think, are on the horizon. The really, really great news, and I want to, in closing, encourage, Joe, you and your work as a leader and listeners, has been the case since the New Testament times. The Lord Jesus Christ can be trusted to supply the needs of his church and guide us to creative solutions to the challenges that local churches face all over the world and in rural America. Mm-hmm. And I really want to end on that very proactive and positive note. Jesus has got us. And so when we face situations that are over our head, that's by his design. It creates dependence in our hearts. And the results typically and historically are phenomenal. God does works that we didn't invent or expect. And I just want to encourage every leader listening to this podcast to have that heart. You just wait to see what God will do. Trust him. Keep learning. Yeah. And then wait to see what solutions he provides.
Wow. You know, I'm 32 years old. And so when someone my age says, you know, God's got this, it means a lot. And you are, let's just say, more than 32 years old. We'll just put it that way. And when you say, hey, God's got us, looking back at 40 years of pastoral ministry, 8 years as president of an institution, I put a lot of hope in that because I can see from your testimony in your life that you put a lot of faith in the Lord. And so thank you for that note. Thank you for this podcast. And I just want to say thank you for being on today.
It's been my privilege, Joe. Thank you. Blessings on you and your ministry.
Absolutely. Well, from all of us at Rural Advancement, we hope that you've tuned into both parts of this conversation, and really just gleaned a lot. Like I said, a lot of the game of winning in church leadership really comes down to understanding what's at play and understanding the dynamics that may be operating under the surface. And so I hope that you have dove into this wealth of knowledge in the same way that I have and gleaned from it. I hope that it helps you do the work that God has called you to do in small, out-of-the-way places. Because again, it is our goal all the time, 100% of the time, to make sure that you feel equipped by people who get your situation so that God's work can be done wherever you're at. Once again, you can always find us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Leave us a rating and a review. You can find us at ruraladvancement.com. But true to rural form, I just encourage you to find another leader in your sphere who's working in a small town church and say, hey, there's some conversations I think you would benefit from. Spread the word. For this week, I have been your host, Joe Epley. He has been pastor and college president, Martin Geese, and we'll see you next week.